everyone. Welcome to the Sediment podcast, where we cover the annual meeting of the American Society of Pediatric Nephrology, and we bring you eminent panelists, thoughtful discussions, and a distilled version of events that went on in DC. The conference ended on May 1st. We are recording episode 3 on May 7th. I am your host, Sudha Garimella. I am a pediatric nephrologist in sunny Greenville, South Carolina. I have here panelists, and I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves and give us some fun facts about themselves. And we will be talking in this episode about clinical nephrology, clinical pearls, tips and tricks about how we can take care of our patients better. And this is a very super special episode for me because we are very excited to have two of our patient families who are strong advocates for children with CKD on with us today. So without further ado, I'm going to ask first Dr. Adil Kakajiwala. Can you introduce yourself for our listeners?
Hello, everyone. I'm Adil Kakajiwala. I'm one of the nephrologists and intensivists at Children's National Hospital in Washington, D.C., and I'm excited to be on the podcast. I guess a few interesting things about me is I have a passion of learning languages, so that's something I keep myself occupied and busy with, learning languages, currently French, Spanish, and obviously the Indian languages that I grew up learning. But other important, I guess you asked for another movie that or a TV series that I enjoyed thoroughly, and that was Queen's Gambit. I've watched, this is the third time round watching the entire show again, so I'd encourage everyone to watch it, and there's a lot to learn and gain from that show.
Is that the one about chess, Adil?
Yes, it is.
Oh, yes, that was a lovely show. Thank you for that recommendation. And don't be shy, how many languages can you actually speak, Adil? It must be 4, 5, 6?
7.
7, oh my goodness, you are a polyglot. That's amazing. We will move on to our second panelist, Susan Poole. Would you introduce yourself, please?
Hi, everyone. I am Susan Poole. I am the mother of Abigail, who is a 6-year-old renal transplant patient. She received her transplant in October of 2022. So that's why this topic is so important to me and why I'm so happy to be here, because we were fighting with her kidney disease since she was 18 months old. So it's been a long road, but we're very excited with where we're at right now. Fun fact about me is I love karaoke. It doesn't have to be karaoke. If I see a microphone, I will grab it and I will sing into it. I usually embarrass anyone that I'm with and I don't even care. And then for a podcast recommendation, I'm going to shamelessly plug my father because he just started a podcast. He's a farmer. And so he started a podcast called View from the Tractor. And he talks about, him and my brother do it together. And he talks about what it's like to be a family farmer and food shortages and just telling people where their food comes from and what it's like to, you know, talk to the person who's growing your food.
That sounds amazing, Susan. I would listen to that, honestly. I'm just an aspirational farmer right now, but I would love to hear, you know, all about this. And this is amazing. And thank you so much for coming on and talking with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Move on to Dr. Kaushal Amatya.
Hi, Sudha. Thank you so much for having me today. I'm Kaushal Amatya. I am the psychologist with the Kidney and Heart Transplant Services at Children's National Hospital. Here in Washington, D.C., and I've been in the position for about 5 years or so, 6 years, and I really enjoy it, and I love, you know, kind of sharing my story and working with all our patients, patient population and our providers, and it's a really fun opportunity for me today to be able to share some of that with you and all the listeners. A fun fact about me, I'm not as cool as Adil with the languages, but I'm currently learning my 6th language, so I'm a little behind. But I do love movies, and I'm a big movie buff. And yesterday I got a new TV, And I was like, I want to watch something fun, and kind of something very exciting. So I ended up watching Chicken Run, which if you haven't seen, is a claymation, like an animated movie. It was a claymation. I love claymation movies. And it's about like chicken who are trying to run away from their farm. It's really, really fun and it's really silly, but I had a blast watching it on my like big screen TV yesterday. So yeah, that's a fun fact about me this weekend.
Hey, listen, no arguments from my end. I love Chicken Run. So that was a great animation movie. So if you haven't watched it, I would highly recommend it too. Thank you for that recommendation. That's amazing.
Yeah, it just got put on Netflix. So go watch it.
All right. And that brings us to our next panelist, Patricia Quinteros. You want to introduce yourself?
Hello, everybody. So first, thank you for having us. And this podcast is an honor, you know, to share our story. I'm Alison Quinteros' mom. And like Misu said, she just got her kidney transplant on February 21st this year.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So we are very happy, you know, slowly recovering, but we're really happy and excited and trying to follow everything, you know, but that's why we are here. And fun, I can say that what I like, you know, I like read books. I really love reading books, movies, and dance. That's what I like to do. I love movies. We watch movies together with my kids and read. I like any kind of books. Horror books, romantic, ooh, you know, and dance, any kind of music. I love dance. So I'm excited to be here too.
Excellent. Wonderful. Welcome. Alison, you want to jump in and tell us about your favorite music or anything? I know she's very shy. She was, very, very shy, but I don't want to give away the absolutely fantastic thing she said at the session. We'll get into that. Hi, Alison.
Hi. My name is Alison. Mm-hmm. And a fun fact about me is I really like to draw and paint. And I listen to any type of music, honestly. Like, I'll listen to anything. So, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing that with us. So for a few minutes, we're going to talk to Adil about clinical nephrology session, which I think without any bias, I can say was the most well-attended session at ASPN. Every time we offer something that is of interest to all physicians, not just nephrologists, I think we get a fantastic turnout. So would you agree, Adil? There was an overflow room and I was in the overflow room. So.
Yeah, I didn't hear about it till after the talk when I saw all the tweets talking about the overflow room even being filled. So that was good to know.
Right. So this is a topic that is just hotly contested for so many years. And, you know, at ASN and ASPN, we talk about what is intravenous fluids and, you know, what kind of fluid should we be giving children in what situation. And Adrian Spitzer lecture was part of this session. And we talked about, you know, the history of how we got to this point where we've been using certain IV fluids for children, almost like a knee-jerk default response, right? And that's Dr. Brophy's lecture just kicked off that whole session to a nice framework with the history of how we got here. So what do you want to talk a little bit about the talks before your own talk?
Sure. So Dr. Brophy gave a beautiful talk about how IV fluids came to be. And like he mentioned, it started all the way back during the cholera pandemic when we had to rehydrate patients who had a lot of fluid losses because of the cholera infection. And initially, the most common IV fluid used was 0.9% saline. And the reason they found that when they mixed blood with 0.9% saline, the red cells did not break, they did not lyse. So that was why they thought this was a good solution to be able, that patients should be able to tolerate. But despite the fact that this has been the most common solution, most readily available solution, there has been debate that Now, this normal saline can cause a lot of, can potentially cause some complications and should not be the first choice of IV fluids. Getting back to when we came to thinking about maintenance fluids, I think it was back in probably 1957, right? When Holliday and Sigard, they were the two pioneers who came up with describing something called maintenance IV fluids. And they said, in order to burn energy in the body, you need fluid. And so they calculated the fluid needs on for patients based on what the estimated energy loss was going to be. And then they taught us about adding sodium and potassium in those fluids, similar to add, making the concentration of those fluids similar to breast milk or cow's milk. But that led to us giving very low sodium concentration to those fluids. Then researchers came up and then guidelines said, you know what, we need to step back even from that and think about just using isotonic solutions to prevent the patient's sodium levels from dropping. So it was, they used the word prophylaxis against hyponatremia. And that is now what is contested and debated, since these have actually been universal guidelines to be used in otherwise healthy children. There are exceptions, so it's not for everyone. It's still, the exceptions are well stated in the guidelines, but it's meant for otherwise healthy children.
True, true. And so that framing that, and I think all of us, you know, in kidney world, we were surprised when we teach this, especially, right? Because Dr. Fedorovsky had a great session about how we teach IV fluids. Just framing it in the context of that, I think helps our learners and trainees also recognize why we got here. So I thought it was an excellent lecture by Dr. Brophy, and it was a very good segue to your talk, which, congratulations, it was a really great talk. I really enjoyed listening to it. So just highlights of, you know, your balanced solutions versus abnormal saline. Just give us the highlights of, you know, what are your thoughts in terms of the compare and contrast the two solutions, if you please.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, we talk about the fears of or the concerns that we have of 0.9% saline. And I've been using the word 0.9% saline to avoid the word normal saline and to avoid the conflict of calling it abnormal saline. Yeah. So I've stuck to calling it 0.9% saline. But concerns that can come up with it, there is that 0.9% saline has a high chloride content, much higher than what is present in the human plasma. So, and that runs the risk of the patients developing high chloride levels, which ultimately can lead to acidosis in the blood or a pH that is very low. So that's number one. Number two, there is concern that it can also actually lead to acute kidney injury, which is like sudden, like short onset dysfunction of the kidneys. Number three, it can actually increase potassium levels because of this acidosis and acute kidney injury, which is opposite to what we think about balanced solutions, because balanced solutions contain potassium, but that's a very low concentration of potassium that is very quickly distributed in the patient's blood. So it's in contradiction. Balanced solutions may actually not lead to the degree of hyperkalemia or high potassium levels as we might think, and also actually be a worse culprit for that happening. Additionally, normal saline can lead to inflammation and I can also damage the blood vessels to some extent. There have been some studies which have said that it can lead to coagulation or bleeding disorder and even GI dysfunction. So given all this huge collection of data that we have, and this is all still speculations, and this is all what we think is, studies have contradicted each other. So there's no one hard yes. 0.9% saline is bad, but these are the concerns about it. On the other hand, 0.9% saline has 154 milliequivalents of sodium, but all these balanced solutions tend to have closer to 130 to 140 milliequivalents of sodium in it. So in patients who have traumatic brain injury or cerebral edema, they need to have higher sodium concentrations. So you do not want, it may be prudent to actually use 0.9% saline in those patients and not using balanced solutions. I think the whole crux of what this comes down to, right, is fluids need to be individualized for the patient. I can't say this is universally what I'm going to do for every patient, right? Because when I think about maintenance, we spoke a ton about the choice of fluids. What we did not talk a ton about is on the rate of fluids and how much of fluids you're giving these patients, right? Because the maintenance rate needs to make sure that the total intake that's going into the patient, it has to equal to the output coming out of the patient. And if you balance that, your patient will never get volume overloaded, should not get puffy and swollen, right? So your intake and output should be well matched, and that is ideal maintenance fluids. And then the constituent of the fluid needs to be titrated on the patient. A patient who actually has a low sodium level might actually need the solution having higher sodium. A patient who has who's losing a lot of chloride in their urine because of certain tubular disorders of the kidney might actually benefit from 0.9% saline. So the choice has to be individualized, and the use of a universal generalized protocol might be the wrong way or the wrong way of thinking about maintenance IV fluids.
Yes, I think that was the highlight of that entire session, is that IV fluids are actually drugs, their therapies. Shake awake a sleeping pediatric intern and ask them to write fluid orders. 99.9% of the times, what do they write? They write D5 half normal saline with 20 milliequivalents KCL at maintenance. And so we need to get away from that knee-jerk response, is what I got out of that session, really. And we need to do a better job of teaching it, right, to our trainees, that you got to be more thoughtful when you're writing an order for fluids for our little children, as to what is the target here, what are we trying to achieve, and what exactly is, what are we maintaining with maintenance fluid, right? So that was a great session, that we that your talk was amazing. It went through, you know, acidosis and potassium and AKI, and just kind of gave us a very good overview of balanced solutions and when should you pick what. We also had a session on resuscitation fluids, right? Just so, you know, we talked about trauma and sepsis and what would be good resuscitation fluids. And I think that was a very informative session with a lot of data. And then we put a ribbon around it with Dr. Fedrosky's talk, which was very enjoyable. And I think that the Q&A session also just kind of came up with this, that we need to be available with a toolkit for our pediatric hospitalists, who are usually the folks who are teaching the residents about IV fluids in most hospitals, to kind of give them a framework about how we as nephrologists think about IV fluids and all the data that's out there. So would you agree? Do you have any other thoughts about this, Adil?
No, I agree. I think, every institution, I think, is universal, right? It's not one place or the other. It's a conflict, because the AAP guidelines are what is most commonly used by the hospitals, by the hospitalist team, by other subspecialties. And so there is a knee-jerk reaction to be using 0.9% saline. I will emphasize the AAP guidelines do not mention 0.9% saline. They say use isotonic solutions. It is our knee-jerk reaction that isotonic solution meant 0.9% saline. And if you look at it, solutions like plasmalite and lactated Ringer are isotonic solutions. Well, not lactated Ringer, but plasmalite for sure is an isotonic solution with a sodium of 140. So it should be the go-to solution. I brought up the price difference during the conference, but
yes.
Yes, there is a price, steep price increase of close to $7 if you think about lactate of saline versus plasmalite. But if I am looking at all the complications that saline can cause, the length of stay that it could potentially increase in a hospital, it will certainly outweigh the risk-benefit ratio. I think the number of times me as an ICU physician, we move Tylenol from PO to IV, or many drugs from the enteral route to the IV route, which is a significant increase in price already. So I don't see why a change in IV fluids should be a hindrance as a cost-effective analysis. But obviously, this probably is a bigger talk with hospital administration and other team members of the team as well.
Well, I'm just going to remind you what you said in the talk about it, which is what it's like 3 minutes of ICU time. Thank you so much, Adil. It was great recapping that session. And I think it definitely gets the medal for the best attended session. But a very close contender was our CKD session. And I'm so happy to have, Kaushal here. And Susan, as well as Patricia and Allison, to talk about the CKD session. So we will pivot to that session now. Before we start, I just want to say, Susan and Patricia, you know, our podcast has always been about talking with physicians and people who design these sessions and are sort of, you know, talking to other professional colleagues about the advances in the field. It is very refreshing for us as practicing nephrologists to see our patient families so engaged and so wanting to be part of the conversation. And the best part about the session was that we were dealing with the symptoms. So it gives me great pleasure that you want to engage with the community and teach us about all the things we are getting wrong or which we could do better. So that was really a very interactive session that we had. Kaushal, do you want to start us off with your talk? Because your talk was the first one in the session too. And we talked about fatigue, mood, and sleep. So yes. What kind of things should nephrologists be asking our families?
So that's a pretty big ask in terms of what we should be asking our patients and families. I think the best would be to ask Ms. Poole and Ms. Quinteros, right? But from, you know, my experience, and as I mentioned, you know, with the kidney population, I've been here at Children's, I've been working for almost 6 years, but, you know, in my fellowship and my residency as well, I work with transplant population. So from my experience, I think it's very important for us to not just focus on kind of the depression, anxiety, or this the idea of let's find a diagnosis. And oh, if they're not kind of, they don't qualify for a diagnosis, we don't need to spend too much time on it, right? Which for nephrologists and a lot of, you know, specialty providers, it makes sense because you don't have a lot of time. You don't, that's not your specialty, right? But if there is a specialty provider in your program, like myself, a psychologist or a mental health specialist, could be a social worker, who are able to dedicate a little bit more time, I think that's where we are able to ask more questions. But if you don't have that resource, right, and I'm not in all of our kidney clinics, right, so I think it's still important for our nephrologists and our team members to ask certain questions. So a very roundabout way to answer your question, ask them about how they're doing. Right. And these are pretty quick questions. So our patient representatives today might be able to kind of validate this as well. But, you know, when I ask my patients or our patients about how they're doing, I make it pretty quick. You know, kind of I get a lot of information, but, you know, I'm not asking because I'm doing screeners. I'm not asking a whole lot of questions. And these can be done pretty fast. So for fatigue, you know, just asking about like how their energy level is. And if they have the energy to do things throughout the day, you know, kind of like engage in schoolwork, right? Are they able to catch up with their peers? Do they have to take a long nap after coming back from school? So things like that can just get a quick assessment of the fatigue level. And for sleep, you know, kind of what time do you go to bed? What time do you wake up? Do you get restful sleep? And again, do you have to fall asleep? Like, you know, kind of do you fall asleep at school, and do you have to take naps after school, right? So that can give you a lot of information. And I just ask those questions in like what, less than a minute, right? So, and of course, you know, with the answers, with some discussion might take a little bit longer, but these can absolutely be done in a clinical setting, right? Again, I think moving away from the diagnostic psychiatric kind of assessment is helpful for us to get like an overall idea of what our patients and families are going through, which then brings me to quality of life, which I touched on a little bit at my talk at PAS, because it is a very broad topic. And yes, I have given multiple seminars on just quality of life, little, you know, so like I couldn't talk about it a whole lot in our 20-minute session, but kind of there are lots of like quality of life questionnaires out there that are pretty easy to administer. Does not require a lot of training. So that can be a good start as well. If you want to go with something that's validated, something that's standardized, you know, if that's what you're more comfortable with.
Yes. So yes, absolutely. That is a great introduction to this, because when this happens, right, it's like sort of one of the worst moments in our lives. And I'm a mom, and I will be honest, I was crying when you guys were talking, just thinking about everything you went through. And that happens to me. I just cry. I'm, you know, I just can't. So I was thinking, oh my gosh, like I'm a mom too. And, you know, if this happens, your brain kind of shuts down initially, right? You can't process too much. So in retrospect, now that you've, you know, you've been on this journey in terms of, you know, symptoms, like the day-to-day symptoms that you saw your child facing, or what do you think we can help with?
So it's interesting because when Abigail was diagnosed, she was 18 months old. So it was a very slow decline for us, and we almost didn't know anything different. So there were a lot of symptoms that were very innocuous, and we didn't even know she was having them because we just thought that that's who she was. And, you know, it's funny because she started school in September. She started first grade. She didn't go to kindergarten. I homeschooled her for kindergarten. And I didn't even know that she was as exhausted as she was at school until we were in clinic one day. And she, her typical response to everything was fine, fine. I'm fine. I'm great. I'm great. And one day she randomly mentioned to Dr. Ahn that she was crying at school because she was so tired, and they made her eat lunch with the school nurse. And I said, Abigail, you never told me that. And she said, I forgot. And, you know, that was her. And so there were some symptoms that we just didn't know. And she was so active for a child at her stage. I mean, she was so uremic going into dialysis. Her BUN was 100. And she was still bouncing up in the morning, coming around the stairs, like running around. And I remember talking to the nephrologist saying, I don't even want to know what she's going to be like when she gets transplanted. Because if this is her with a BUN of 100, I don't know if I'm ready for it. But so the questions that are asked, those leading questions that seem like they don't mean very much, you know, like, are you tired at school? They really bring out a lot that I wouldn't have otherwise known, because she was 6 years old. She didn't know what to tell me and how to tell me how she felt. You know, the only thing she ever complained of was at nighttime, she would be so tired and she would say her legs hurt. And that's it. That honestly, she was never nauseous. She never complained of nausea. I will say, judging by her diet decreasing, and her intake decreasing over that last year so rapidly, in retrospect, I'm like, she must have been very nauseous, but she didn't know how to verbalize that to me. And so much of it had just become her normal, and she didn't know anything but that. I can imagine it's a lot more difficult for someone Allison's age, because she was very well aware of what normal was and right. Then what it suddenly wasn't. And she went, boom, acute renal failure. Whereas Abby, it was just this slow, insidious decline. And we had never known any different.
Right. And that's the thing too, is that with that slow, insidious decline, you know, it establishes a new normal, and you don't think about it as a problem to mention also sometimes.
Yep, exactly.
But Allison, in Allison's experience, I mean, this was like a bolt from the blue for you guys, right? She was just suddenly so sick all of a sudden. But as she went through that process, what kind of symptoms bothered her most? What were the things that you felt like, you know, we need to know more about?
You know, she complained more about the tiredness. And like Dr. A said at the conference, with just asking them, how you doing? How was your day? Or how you feeling? That question opens to a lot with a kid, you know, on Allison's age. You know, and like Misu said, so since 18 months old, she was sick, so didn't have that, like realize of those symptoms, you know. Mm-hmm. But Allison, all the time, she always, since she was born, was healthy, no illness at all, barely get a flu or a cold, not even that, you know. And then just like that, mm-hmm. start feeling tired. And she, one of the symptoms I forgot to mention at the conference was she was complaining about back pain. And she said, "Mom, I have a back pain, and always maybe you slept, you know, a bad move, or you did a certain move, and that's why." And kind of almost every day, but when we don't know anything about it, so we just, what is this, you know? But that was one of the things she complains, the back pain. And the other, the tiredness. From the kitchen to the living room, she was tired, like she was working all day long. And we didn't know why, you know, so why? And then nauseous, that all of that. And she said that she was feeling puffy. And that, you know, all that fluid that she was retaining, because the how sick she was feeling, she wasn't peeing, and she didn't notice that. You know, she didn't notice that. And when the doctor said she's retaining fluid because she's not peeing, I asked her, are you been peeing? And she said, I don't know. Honestly, I haven't noticed that. She was feeling so sick, she didn't notice that. Now, you know, it's like every day, are you okay? Are you peeing? Do you drink? You know, but when she was on dialysis, I was like, sweetie, don't drink the mash. You know, you're not supposed to drink the mash. Now it's like, remember, you have to drink water. Remember, you have to drink. And Dr. Ann and all the doctors, they told us that when the kids get the transplant, it's one of the kind of difficult for them because they've been used to it. You know, that restricted diet, the fluids, all of that. So when they get the transplant, they so used to that there's like they forget to do it. And we had to be reminding them, you know.
That's right, Patricia. You know, that is just a big flip over from being a restriction to a goal, right, Kaushal?
Definitely. Yeah. That's one of the biggest thing that I work with. The same patients before and after transplant, before is adherence to fluid restrictions. And the same patients who have a lot of issues and are drinking a lot, like suddenly after transplant, they're not drinking as much. And we have to have reward systems and kind of goals, special bottles to make sure that they're drinking. And as a psychologist, you know, kind of, I wish I had like a straightforward explanation of, you know, what's going on there, but it's kind of very, almost like, I know some part of, you know, what's going on, but it feels very mysterious. It's kind of strange that the same patients who were drinking too much before dialysis or before transplant rather, are now drinking way less than they should. But you know, people, it's an adjustment, right? And there, especially for teenagers and younger kids too, there's this, you know, kind of limit testing, boundaries testing, right? And they want to do some things that they're not allowed to. And when they're like, oh, you're allowed to drink as much as you want, they're like, oh, okay, whatever.
So now I won't.
Exactly, yeah. So we see a little bit of that as well. Yes. But you know, all of our patients, or most of them, I would say, like eventually reach their goals, right? And they're able to drink a lot. And the good thing is that after transplant, overall quality of life improves as well.
Would you agree, Allison?
Yeah. About the drinking the water, like when I first got my transplant, I came back home. I'm supposed to drink a lot of water, right? But when I was drinking my water, it felt so wrong to drink water. I was like, am I supposed to be drinking this? Like it was still
the
there.
Doctors know what they're doing.
Yeah, like it was still there. Like, I don't know if I'm supposed to drink this, but then I'm like, I am. But then I'm like, I don't know. Like, I don't know if, like, you know.
Yes, it's like exchanging one set of instructions for another set of instructions, right? And I think when I was sitting through that session and doing some reflection, what I thought was, you were so right, both families, you were right when you said that, you know, the framework of how we present it is so important. that the transplant is not a cure to all the issues. It's just another way to take care of your life with chronic kidney disease. And I thought that was very well put by both of you during that. It is a journey, and the transplant is a tool just like dialysis, and you've got to kind of frame that. But that's where I remember, Allison, you said something right at the end. Do you want to share that?
Yeah, because we were talking about how a kidney transplant isn't a cure. Like, it eventually in the future it's gonna come back. But I said that I was gonna enjoy it while I can.
Yes, you know, I'm gonna enjoy it now when I have it, and that was amazing. And it just shows me, at least, you know, is how resilient you are, you know, our wonderful families and patients. And we feel blessed to be able to take care of you and, you know, get to know you and interact with you all. And I have my own families of patients who, you know, I could not persuade to come on this podcast. They're too shy. But maybe one day. But, you know, lovely journeys that, you know, people are sharing with us. So we not only do the science of it right, but also along the way, make sure that we are taking care of the symptoms of CKD and just living life with chronic kidney disease, what would be best practices. There was a lot of discussion about school, right? And Susan, I remember you were like, I'm taking notes because my little one is going to grow up. But it is still sort of the statistics are very sobering about how many of our children who go through this problem are actually able to graduate and hold a job down and get insurance that helps take care of their transplants or their life with CKD. And Kaushal, do you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. And from my experience, what has happened is, you know, a lot of the times, if there are no resources available in the clinic or in the community, oftentimes what happens is, you know, these patients fall through the cracks, right? And again, I'm not blaming the nephrologist or other team members, but, you know, a lot of times you don't have the time to ask these questions. How are you doing at school? Do you need any help with setting up services at school? And I think that's where the issues kind of start and snowball into these later issues in life, right? So what I'm hoping is that in kind of with more interventions, early interventions, we'll be able to see that, you know, kind of our patients are able to, you know, kind of graduate from high school. That's something that we absolutely, you know, kind of strive for in our clinic, at least. And I do want to see like what our hospital's statistics are on that, because since I've started, at least, and kind of kudos to our social workers who have done an excellent job with this. But I think because we have that those resources available, I want to see what the statistics are, because from what I remember, at least, maybe our patients don't graduate at 18. Actually, like, well, there's a certain number who absolutely do, but there's a good number who don't graduate at 18. But they do graduate at, you know, kind of 19, 20, or they get a GED. But I think we have very few. And I kind of recall from the last 6 years, if I can think of one patient who dropped out of school and did not get a GED, but the others, you know, at least have kind of gone towards getting a GED. But that's what we're trying to set up, is like, you know, if, you know, alternative ways to get a degree is what they are able to do, right? Let's go for that, right? But still the idea is that they need that support and the resources to be able to do these things. And I know our other speaker did talk a little bit about like school services, but like, especially in this podcast, I definitely want to kind of put in a big word for school 504 plans and IEP evaluations and having an IEP at school. And I think, you know, kind of like when I, and it still happens, especially when I start seeing the patients in more like the CKD clinics, by the time they get to dialysis, and especially by the time they get to transplant, I know them pretty well. Our social workers know them pretty well. So we have, you know, pretty much asked them about like these things. But when I first started asking in the transplant clinic and the general CKD clinic as well, about, oh, like, does the patient have a 504 plan or an IEP? Like, the families don't know what those are.
Right.
Right. And that these exist. And even if it's not an IEP and if that's not what's needed, just, you know, if they're having issues with the teachers, giving them a break when they need to drink water or use the bathroom, right? Things like that. Some families don't know that we can actually help with that, right? So just letting them know that we have resources and we can get them IEPs, we can get them home hospital teaching if needed, right? So those are very important like factors to remember and know. So for a nephrologist who might be listening, like, you know, even if you're, if you don't have the resources, just taking a little bit of time, maybe just like, how are things at school? How are your grades, right? Like, does, especially does your CKD impact your grades in any way? Might open up a lot of doors, right, for the families to ask questions, to receive services. So at least like help the patients get 504 plans. And that's a great first step.
Yes, yes. So Susan, I know that your child is just starting on this journey. So tell us about your thoughts.
Well, even just starting, she just started first grade. And then in September, she had been in school for 4 weeks. She was admitted for her dialysis catheter. When on dialysis, we didn't send her while she was on dialysis because she was going to dialysis 3 days a week. So it felt like, what's the point? And then she was transplanted in October. She's never been back. So they've already told us she's repeating first grade. So I already feel like we're going to have that struggle. And I already feel like we have hurdles that we're going to have to jump through, no fault of her own. She's a very motivated learner, especially now that she's transplanted and she has the energy for it. She goes to private school. I don't know anything about IEPs or 504s. I don't even know if they do them. It was never mentioned to us. And so I feel like we're in a place where it's going to get scary, maybe. I don't know. Just we're going to have to push hard to make sure that she doesn't fall behind and fall through the cracks.
Yes, but I think we had some data there, which was a little reassuring that it may be delayed graduation, but you would still get there. So I think at this point, that is the ray of hope we have. And everything we talked about, right, the sleep, the fatigue, the mood, all of that, I mean, I imagine that you can't really focus on learning some new material when you feel that way. So we have to cut some slack for our kids and design an educational curriculum for them that meets their needs and meet them where they are. So Kaushal is right that this is a need and all nephrologists need to be making sure of that. Are you facing that too, Allison? Do you find it hard to study?
Yeah, I do. I've been like when I was first diagnosed, I like didn't go to school for like 3 months and like I missed a lot. So I obviously failed like some classes. And then this year I was still missing a lot of school. So I wouldn't go because I would feel sick or tired. And like my only option to like actually, if I want to graduate on time, I think is doing summer school.
Extra work.
Yeah, extra work.
So trying you put more load on yourself. Yeah.
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 Yes. And about wish you all the best in your educational quest and all success. Kaushal, you have a thought about this?
Oh, sorry. I think Allison's mom, Ms. Patricia, you were going to add something?
They're about the forms, the 504 and all of that. Mm-hmm. We didn't know anything about that either, you know, because we wasn't on that place, you know. But when we got there, and the social workers at the hospital, they mention all of that and they help us to fill out all those forms. And while she was on dialysis, so the hospital sent paperwork, everything to school, she was going half day to school. So that way she didn't miss that much school and she can go to the treatment, you know? So, right. But still, she was on dialysis, but she was going like one day a week, 2 days a week, because she didn't feel like getting up or, you know, like she didn't want to do anything really.
Yeah, my motivation wasn't there.
Yeah.
Yes, that's understandable, you know, and everything that, you know, we unfortunately have to put you through for this does interfere with that. So I think it was a great session for that reason, because it allowed us a chance to reflect and dwell upon all the things that we still need to do. One of the hurdles we have as physicians is that, of course, you know, insurance rules as well as school education changes from state to state. So mm-hmm. we can't really learn from group wisdom, because I can't ask Kaushal, for example, because I'm in South Carolina, everything's different here. He's in DC, everything's different there. So we, each one of us in our own state, we have to figure out what our local resources are for education as well as insurance. So I think that is the reason why we are not able to move the needle on this very much. So advocacy committee, if you are listening to this podcast, we need help. We need help for our families, for, you know, improving their educational outcomes and making sure that the future of America is in safe and secure hands, like Allison and Susan. Your daughter's name is
Abigail.
Abigail, right? Yes, they're like Abigail and Allison. So you can take care of us when we are old and in the nursing homes, right, Allison?
Yes. Abby says she wants to be a nurse like her mama. So hopefully that will be an actual thing for her.
That is wonderful. Yes. And just at the session, the other thing that struck me was that even, you know, Susan, you being a nurse and in the profession, healthcare profession, you still had so many hurdles and so many new things that you came up across taking care of Abigail that surprised you, right? And so it's a learning curve for even people who are in the healthcare profession taking care of children along that CKD continuum. Kaushal.
Yeah, and it's definitely a learning experience for all the providers as well, right? So we do want to see our patients as individuals, not just as aggregates, although of course, kind of this, everything that we do is based on aggregates, based on research, right? They're evidence-based, but the few things, you know, that I also wanted to mention about school and about kind of life and kind of managing symptoms is that, you know, kind of all the things do get better. We do see that, you know, as we've talked about, like a little bit of a lag, but our patients, again, from my experience, have been really able to live a really wonderful life. We've had many, many patients, you know, go to college, graduate from college. I know at ASPN, there are some MDs, some physicians who have had CKD and transplant before. I believe another conference, like a transplant society, recently had a talk on from providers who have had transplants, heart and kidney transplants. So it is really incredible to see that our patients are really able to do quite a lot, right?
Yes.
But we have
one of my residents used to work in Buffalo, New York, and mm-hmm. one of my residents actually started out with our program as a baby and then grew up and went to med school and became a physician. Just didn't go into nephrology doing general peds, but, you know, again, life happens. But that's that. I'm so proud.
And it's great that they're doing children. General peds and pediatricians, right? Like that's where a lot of this preventative works come from. So hopefully he's taking all that knowledge.
Oh, he is amazing. Care. I don't want to name him, but he's amazing. And I think of him often, even though I'm no longer in Buffalo. He's a great role model for young people. The sky is the limit, you know, mm-hmm. you should just, and hopefully by the time Abigail is old enough and in high school and college, our outcomes will move the needle a little bit more.
Yeah.
So that was a great recap of the session.
Yes, certainly for me. I think, again, what I would want to leave y'all with is that for our patients, they're going through quite a lot, right? Like utilize your resources. I think referring not just within the hospital, but within the community as well. Like if you have concerns, ask about those concerns. Don't sweep them under the rug. Please ask our patients. And there are, as I mentioned in my talk, lots of different measures, like standardized measures that you can use that are screening tools that can provide you with a lot of information. And patients and families can fill this out while they're in the waiting room or while they're in the labs, right? So you don't necessarily have to sit there and ask these questions. So use those forms, check them out. And if you see that they're struggling through something, reach out to social workers, reach out to psychologists like myself, if there is one in your hospital, because there are resources that you can use. They might be few and not very common to find, very easy to find, but there are out there.
And just that reminds me that the ASPN does run a great conference each year for our dietitians, our social workers, as well as for the psychologists, which has a complete team of taking care of children with kidney diseases. And it's a great resource if you feel isolated in your practice and you're the only dietitian taking care of renal patients. It's a great conference and a great network. There's also a listserv and a very active community of people who are passionate about taking care of children with kidney diseases. So that's our little plug for the conference. It's a wonderful conference. And Kaushal, I know that you've been a speaker there before. So that is one. And if you are someone who is facing kidney disease, living with kidney disease and listening to us, when you go to see your doctor, when you go to see your social worker and your dietitian, talk to them about these symptoms, because don't let them just worry about treating the disease and the medications, but also your quality of life, how you sleep, what your mood is like. And in talking with Susan and Patricia, you know, as parents, you can be the strongest advocates for your children. The pediatric nephrology community is great. I think that we are very much partners in this with our parents and families. And I think we have developed a culture of trying our best to listen to our families and meet you where you are, which is what I heard at the conference from both of you all with your experiences with your individual nephrologists and practices. So I think kudos to everybody who's working in this field, and all of my sort of lots of admiration for families who are raising children with kidney disease. So last thoughts, lessons, what do you want us all to know? Patricia and Allison, you can go first and then Susan.
One thing, I don't know if each state is different or doctors, I don't know. But you know, before she got diagnosed, when she got diagnosed, I asked her pediatrician that why she didn't do that test, for the kidney levels. And she told me, we don't do those tests on children because this is not a children illness. This is for adults. And when we got to the dialysis unit at children's, and I saw all those little ones, babies, I said, how the doctor can say this is not a children illness? So one thing I think they should do is do this test, where they can see the kidney levels. Because think if they do that, maybe parents or families, we can do something different to avoid to get to that point, So I think that's something that should change on medicine, with pediatricians.
Absolutely. Yeah. We hear you, Patricia. And yes, it is, kidney disease is, silent. And, symptoms are usually much evident when you've lost a lot of kidney function. So as nephrologists, we're always trying to educate the community and say that, unless you do a blood test, you won't even know by the time the patient comes to you and tells you they don't feel good, they've lost a significant amount of their kidney function. So that's a great point, absolutely a learning point for all of us.
So I'm very excited to start researching all the IV fluid stuff because that's just every day where everyone's like normal saline. So I'm very excited about that. I can't wait to dig into that. But my experiences have made me a better mom. They've made me a better nurse. I didn't know I had a voice as loud as I did until these experiences. And I hate that I had to figure that out. But if it had to happen, then it's okay, because it's made me a different person, all of the experiences, and even at work every day, it has encouraged me. It has brought to light a new field for me to dig into. I'm an ER nurse, and so in a formerly PICU, but we're focused on the whole and not always necessarily each system. And so having a child who had kidney disease opened my eyes to a whole new world that I never knew went as deep as it goes. And I find myself, at work, they'll be talking about a patient I'll hear, and I'll say, what's their GFR? And, you know, I'll start digging into them. I'm like, no, you need to stop doing that. And, you know, it's so funny. I'm in a community ER, and we got a kid one day who is a transplant patient from Children's, and they started the treatment plan. And I said, I don't think that's going to work. Let's go ahead and get them on the phone. They're like, oh, we could start. I'm like, no. I know these people. They'll want to be involved. And so it's just, it's really funny. It's a whole new community that we've gotten involved in, you know, against my will, of course, but happily here we are. So it changes your life. It is what it is. We're here, we're making the best of it. And we're learning a lot, and we're having some pretty wonderful experiences along the way.
Absolutely. That's wonderful. And we always, the aim for us is to not let the disease define the person. So, you know, we look at young people like Abigail and Allison, and we do everything we can with all of our excellent team members and partners, you know, like Dr. Amathia here, as well as dietitians and social workers and all the resources, the teachers at the school who are excellent, by the way, you know, good partners to the pediatricians. And, you know, the number of things that go into making a successful outcome for a patient who has chronic kidney disease, it's just immense. But it's teamwork. And I think the session kind of opened our eyes to where we are failing and where we can do better. But it also really was it was a love song to, you know, how resilient our children are and how well they do given all the tough breaks they get. So I fell in love again with my profession at the end of the session. I felt more energized to do better and take care of young people. I absolutely adored the elan with which you said, yeah, I got it now and I'm going to enjoy it. It was lovely. And so thank you so much for taking your time out on a Sunday evening to chat with me about all of this. I really appreciate all of you coming on the podcast. And so I think we're going to end it here now. We will wish you all the best in your future, both of the children as well as the families. And to all the families out there, please let us know how we can do better. Your voice has to be strong and has to be equal to the people who take care of your children. So thank you and good night.